must accept such demand of the nation. This is because we are facing serious challenges such as joblessness and poverty.
In the meantime, the Taliban spokesman says the current government is an interim one and that works are underway to establish an inclusive government. According to the group, the future Afghan government will convince the world to recognize the Taliban-appointed government as the legitimate government of Afghanistan. The Taliban are struggling to form their government, while the resistance front in Panjshir Valley says it will never accept the rule of the Taliban over Afghanistan unless they say yes to the main demands of Afghans. Demands such as forming a real inclusive government that does not deprive women and girls of their basic rights and paying respect to social and cultural liberties of people. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
According to the results of parliamentary elections in Russia, United Russia ruling party received a constitutional majority in the State Duma. The Communist Party took the second place, with the Liberal Democratic Party the third one. Then goes Fair Russia and New People. Thus, these five parties overcome the 5% barrier to enter the State Duma. United Russia is promoting President Vladimir Putin's agenda, which is also enshrined in last year's social amendments to the Constitution.
I want to thank all our voters who voted for United Russia and our candidates. This is a great trust and no less great responsibility for us. I also want to thank those who voted for other political parties. We respect your position and the choice you made.
The State Duma is elected in Russia for a five-year term under a mixed system. 225 deputies, according to party lists, another 225 in single-mandate constituencies in one round. The results haven't been without controversy, however. There have been widespread accusations of fraud and misconduct. Throughout the 3 days of voting, many videos shared online appeared to show voters and officials stuffing ballot boxes with multiple voting slips. In Moscow, some opposition figures accused officials of delaying the release of online voting results to give them an opportunity to manipulate. In response, Kremlin hailed the parliamentary elections as open, competitive, and honest.
Voter turnout was notably high, especially on the last day of voting. This election will also be remembered by a large number of candidates.
The team of jailed opposition figure Alexei Navalny accused the authorities of foul play, declaring all the victories against his candidates they supported as part of a controversial smart voting scheme as falsification. Earlier before the elections, Russia's telecom watchdog demanded the Navalny app be removed from App Store and Google Play based on a ruling by the Russian Prosecutor General's office.
For the first time this year's federal elections in Russia took place over 3 days. This year, election organizers have also introduced electronic voting devices. So far, residents of only seven regions in Russia have been able to vote using these devices. According to the Constitution, the new State Duma should meet on the 30th day following the election day.
But the president has the right to convene the first meeting of the lower house of parliament even earlier than this date. The Russian president has already exercised this right after previous elections. Марина Картунова, Москва.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
A leader in the true sense of the word, February 3rd, 2021. Fatemeh Zahra, peace be upon her, is the leading lady of all the women of the world. She is the lady who at a young age and during her short life gained wisdom, knowledge, and high spiritual levels and reached such a status that was equivalent to that of the Prophet and the guardians of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. In fact, Fatemeh Zahra is a radiant dawn from which shines the sun of imamate, guardianship, and prophethood. She is the lofty sky in whose lap the luminous stars of guardianship have been placed. Hassan al-Basri relates about Fatemeh Zahra, peace be upon her, the daughter of the Prophet would worship God and stand in her prayer niche so much that her feet would become swollen. Imam al-Hassan al-Mujtaba, peace be upon him, said, One of the nights before Friday, my mother started to perform prayers and she prayed until morning. She prayed for the people and prayed for the public affairs of the Islamic world. In the morning, I asked her, you did not pray for anything for yourself. You prayed the whole night, but you only prayed for others. She answered, my son, first others, then ourselves. This shows the loftiness of her spirit. Fatemeh Zahra, peace be upon her, is the one about whom the Holy Prophet told the commander of the faithful, peace be upon him, O Ali, you are the one who will guide the male believers to heaven, and Fatima will guide the female believers to heaven on the Day of Judgment. That is, on the Day of Judgment, the commander of the faithful, peace be upon him, will guide the believing men, and Fatemeh Zahra, peace be upon her, will guide the believing woman into the divine paradise. She is the tantamount, equivalent, and comparable to the commander of the faithful, peace be upon him. At a young age, Fatemeh Zahra, peace be upon her, achieved such a high level of spirituality that according to certain narration, the angels spoke and showed some truth to her. She was called Al-Muhaddatha, which means someone who is with whom the angel speaks.
You've done. defense, a mirror of Ashura. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. The 8-year imposed war of the 1980s was full of epic scenes, and as the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has said, it is an unending treasury for the Iranian nation. However, the role of women in that unforgettable period was as much important and determining as that of men. Women as mothers, sisters, and wives played a very great role in setting the ground for men's best presence in the battlefields. Women proved that, like the women of the first years of Islam, shoulder to shoulder with men, they served as preparatory and supportive forces behind the fronts. Although some of them also helped the combatants in the battlefields as nurses and medical staff. The Iranian women took Lady Zainab as the role model. Zainab, the sister of Imam Hussein, did her best to support the brothers' uprising. Her main role was seen after the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, in the position of the messenger of the uprising to continue the effect of the bloods of martyrs. However, during the heat of the war too, Zainab made every effort to accompany Imam Hussein. When her nephew Ali Akbar plunged in his blood, Zainab tried to strengthen Imam Hussein's morale. This also happened at the martyrdom of Qasim, the son of Imam Hassan, peace upon him. Yet, when Lady Zainab's own sons, Own and Muhammad, were martyred, she didn't come out of the tent not to embarrass him. She told herself, "These were two small gifts to God. So it is not good to go to my sons and cause pain to Hussein's heart with crying and moaning." But she looks through the tent that Hussein dismounts and hugs his nephews. It is very hard for mothers to tolerate the loss of children. The mothers of martyrs of the 8-year imposed war followed Lady Zainab, peace upon her, and patiently tolerated this great pain. Upon hearing the news of their son's martyrdom, these great ladies would thank God and ask him to accept their sacrifice. Many of these mothers would bury their sons themselves. Robabe Fallahzadeh, the mother of three martyrs, said, "I am not upset at the martyrdom of my sons. But the only thing that I want from the youth and the people is to continue the path of martyrs and do not do anything that does not please God." Umm al-Banin, the wife of Imam Ali, after the martyrdom of Lady Fatimah al-Zahra, peace upon her, sent his four sons with Imam Hussein, peace upon him, to the field of Karbala. She emphasized that they should never let the grandson of the Prophet be lonely. After the event of Ashura, she was very worried, and she faced a man called Bashir, who was coming from Karbala. She asked him, "What's happened?" He said, "Your Abbas was martyred." She asked again, "What news do you have?" He answered, "Your other sons, Abdullah, Usman, and Ja'far, were also martyred." Umm al-Banin inquired him for the third time with these words, "Speak to me of Hussein." May all my children and whatever there is under this sky be sacrificed for Hussein. Tell me, what about Hussein? Then Bashir said that Hussein was also martyred. At that moment, Umm al-Banin moaned very painfully and hugged her knees sadly. The Iranian women followed the role models of great ladies like Zainab and Umm al-Banin during the Islamic Revolution and the Holy Defense. These mothers didn't think for a single moment that they might lose their sons. Many of these ladies encouraged their sons to go to the front to obey the command of Imam Khomeini. Imam Khomeini, in several occasions during the struggles of the Islamic Revolution and the 8-year imposed war, stressed that the role of women in the formation and victory of the revolution and the victory of the Iranian nation in the war was even more important than that of men. Ayatollah Khamenei said on the role of mothers, of martyrs, the mother of two martyrs, the mother of three martyrs, the mother of four martyrs is not a joke. This is easy to say. When our child catches cold and coughs, how much are we worried? One's child goes and is killed. The second one goes and is killed. The third one goes and is killed. Is this a joke? And this mother, with the very proper motherly emotions that are gushing forth, plays such a role that she persuades 100 other mothers to send their children to the war. If these mothers would moan and whine when their son's body comes or even doesn't come, complain, protest against the imam and the war, then the war would certainly be paralyzed in the very first years and the first phase. This is the role of martyrs, mothers.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, says Iran is ready to resume talks on restoring the 2015 nuclear deal very soon. However, he says U.S. is sending a negative signal by keeping and even intensifying sanctions on Iran. In an interview with U.S. media, Amir Abdullahian said Washington has taken no action to prove its readiness to return to the deal. He said the existing U.S. approach contradicts President Joe Biden's criticism of its predecessor's policy toward Iran. Former U.S. President Donald Trump pulled the U.S. out of the deal back in 2018 and reimposed crippling sanctions on Iran. Tehran, still adhering to the deal, began reducing its nuclear deal-related commitments a year later. Since the Biden administration took office, Iran and the remaining signatories to the deal have held six rounds of talks in Vienna in an effort to revive the accord. For more on that, we're now joined by our correspondent, Toma Lesgiu, who's with us from the Austrian capital, Vienna. Homa, what details do you have to share with us and our viewers?
Yes, Badia, that's right. So six rounds of negotiations have been held, of course, under the previous administration of Hassan Rouhani. And now it seems that we're going to have a resumption of these talks. We don't know when it's going to happen, how it's going to happen. Of course, we're expecting a new team from the Iranian side. But of course, I guess the fundamental policies that have been pursued by the Iranian side are not changing when it comes to the demands that Iran is making in these talks. We also heard the U.S. President Biden at the U.N. General Assembly saying that the United States is also prepared to return to full compliance. But the key question here is, what is full compliance as far as Iran is concerned and as far as the U.S. is concerned? Those are questions that, of course, have been raised time and time again during the Vienna talks. For instance, Iran saying that it wants all of the U.S. sanctions, both the JCPOA-related ones and also the additional sanctions imposed under the Trump administration, to be fully removed. And at the same time, it wants to verify their removal before it returns to full compliance. This was seen as a sticking point in the talks. Another issue, of course, has been what sanctions the U.S. is prepared to lift. Apparently, the U.S. was not willing to lift all of the sanctions that Iran was asking for, and also Iran calling for guarantees that the JCPOA will indeed remain alive and there won't be another decision by this or another U.S. administration, for instance, to withdraw from it and to simply violate it. So we'll have to see, of course, the readiness has been expressed by all sides that they want these talks to resume. And, of course, everyone has expressed hope that they hope that these continuation of these talks will lead to the revival of the deal. But, of course, it has been a very complicated process.
All right. Thanks, Homa Lesgi, joining us from the Austrian capital, Vienna. Joining us, though, on tonight's Spotlight, we have journalist and political analyst John Bosnich, who's joining us from Belgrade. And also we have journalist and author Daniel Azar, who's with us from New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let's start off with Mr. Bosnich in Belgrade. It's great to have you with us here on Press TV Spotlight. Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdullahian, says that Iran is ready to resume talks on reviving the 2015 nuclear deal, but the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden is sending, quote-unquote, negative signals and a negative sign by keeping illegal sanctions on Tehran. In your opinion, why is the U.S. Keeping those sanctions in place?
Well, we've mentioned this before in earlier discussions on the topic, and that is because there's a very, very powerful Israel lobby in the United States, which has incredible power over both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. And there are costs to pay if you make moves against the Israel lobby in U.S. politics. So Biden has not yet arranged permission, in effect, from Israel to take action on this topic. And that's the crux of the problem, although most people don't want to talk about that in the United States.
Let's cross over to Daniel Lazar in New York. It's great to have you with us here on the program. Mr. Lazar, the top Iranian diplomat, he said that Biden needed to take back, needed to back up his talk of diplomacy with concrete actions to show Iran that Washington is serious about restoring the nuclear deal. Is Washington serious, in your opinion, or does it have ulterior motives regarding the revival of the deal?
I don't think it is serious, no. I think that it wants to revise the deal, take into account a whole range of non-nuclear activities by Iran, which is clearly beyond the scope, beyond the logic of the 2015 nuclear accord. So I think that essentially is going to kill any hope of reviving the deal. Your previous guest is correct that the Israeli lobby, pro-Israel lobby, is a major force behind this kind of thinking. But equally important are the Gulf states, Saudi Arabia. The U.S. has constructed an entire defense network based on reigning in Iran, and Biden is not willing to alter that in any significant way. In fact, he wants to tighten the circle around Iran and use a revived 2015 nuclear accord as a means of doing so.
So I have this question scheduled for later on, but as you brought it up, I'm going to address it to both of you right now. Mr. Bosnich, who benefits from this limbo, from this uncertainty of the Iran nuclear deal?
Well, the military-industrial complex, because it allows them to lobby for further investment in so-called defensive measures against Iran. I mean, it's an absurdity on the face of it. Iran poses no military threat whatsoever to the United States, and Iran poses no military threat to anyone in the region. Iran is a strong country, has a large population, a well-educated population, and Iran has the right to defend itself. But who benefits from the limbo? The limbo benefits those who hate Iran. Those who want to destroy the Iranian economy, who want to destabilize Iran, and to make Iran a non-player in its own region. Those are the persons and the states and the entities that are benefiting. And you are correct, your other guest is correct in saying that it is not only the Israel lobby, but there is a very strong lobby led largely by Saudi Arabia, which also wants to restrict the ability of Iran not just to develop its nuclear energy industry, but to restrict Iran's ability to exist as a stable economy.
Daniel Lazar, same question to you.
Well, I mean, I think I agree. I would just add that that Iran, by allying itself with China and to a certain degree with Russia as well, that Iran now is kind of a frontline state. America is pressing its offensive against both Moscow and Beijing, and it sees Iran as being kind of a cat's paw for those two countries. So therefore, for a variety of reasons, U.S. hostility to Iran is extremely high. It's actually only increasing. So therefore, it wants to use, I said before, a revived version of the 2015 nuclear accord in order to put Iran even more on the defensive. So Iran, I mean, I can't imagine Iran ever saying yes to that. And if Biden were to drop his non-nuclear demands, there would be a storm in Washington among pro-Israel, pro-Saudi, pro-Gulf forces, as well as those who are most hostile to Russia and China, which essentially means 95% of the entire U.S. establishment.
I'm going to stay with you, Mr. Lazar. Iran announced that the new administration will resume talks in Vienna, but according to the foreign minister, the Raisi administration neither accepts the U.S.'s unconstructive behavior, nor will it forestall Iran's progress based on Washington's habitually empty promises. The survival of the deal now is basically on the line. Given that Washington is the one that walked away from the international accord, it should be Washington that remedies what it has done first. Do you agree with that?
Oh, I do agree. I mean, yes, of course, legally, there's no doubt about that. The U.S. is the one which broke the deal, and the U.S. therefore should be the one which apologizes for so doing so and enters back into the deal with no other, you know, preconditions. But the U.S. is not going to do that. As I said before, the U.S. is now making a raft of non-nuclear demands, which it insists that Iran agree to as a precondition for any revival of the 2015 nuclear accord. So that's why I think that the negotiations are stalled while they'll go nowhere. I mean, I've always argued the 2015 accord is essentially doomed.
Mr. Bosnich, shouldn't it be Washington demonstrating its seriousness in returning to the deal after President Donald Trump withdrew the U.S. From the deal unilaterally, also coupled with Joe Biden's criticism of his predecessor's policy toward Iran?
Absolutely correct. There's no doubt about it that the initiative to destroy the deal, to block the deal, and to end the deal came from the United States, and the United States did not have grounds for making that move. But you have to remember that U.S. politics is very much a charade. The candidates say what they like during the election term. Whoever wins the election then pursues whatever policies he or she wants to pursue, because there's no accountability. There's no recall. There's no way to force the president to fulfill his promises. There's no way to hold Biden to what he said about the deal. In effect, what happens is every 4 years, the American public is lied to by two candidates who vary on some domestic policy lines, but on international politics, they follow the state line. And the state line is directly dictated to the president by the military-industrial complex that buys all the members of Congress via bribery. So you are not dealing here with a rational, logical progression. You are dealing here with a facade, with a charade politics. And the only way to respond to this is to stand firm and to seek support from other countries which have great power, such as Russia, such as China, and other independent countries around the world. There are still a few of them, and they need to speak out. And they should speak out not just in this forum, but they should also speak out at the United Nations.
Daniel Lazar, a major question here is what assurances can be given that another administration doesn't just come along and leave the deal again like Donald Trump did? Basically, I'm asking, should the U.S. be trusted?
Well, I mean, first of all, number one, I assume the deal will not go through. I assume that Joe Biden will blame it on Iran. And, of course, he'll declare America as guiltless, and America, by definition, is always guiltless. But I think that if by some miracle Joe Biden did go through with the deal, did re-enter the deal, if by some absolute miracle the negotiations in Vienna were successful, then yes, I think there's a very good chance that if the Republicans come back into office in 2024, the first thing they will do will be to abandon this deal.
Mr. Bosnich, would you like to weigh in on that for us, please?
Well, I fully agree, and I think that any deal that's ever signed with the United States of America as it stands now needs to be secured by severe penalty clauses. And those penalty clauses have to be in the language that they understand, and they only understand one language, and that is the language of money. Immense financial penalties for violating the deal. And those financial penalties need to be paid into a third party that's independent, and the monies must flow to Iran to not just punish the violator of the deal, but to also compensate Iran for for the immense losses caused by the sanctions. And I can say that those must be adding up into the hundreds of billions of dollars already. And I think that that would cause some pain in Washington if such money had to be deposited in a neutral third party before any deal would take effect. They only understand money. Mammon is their god, and you have to speak to him in those terms.
Daniel Azar, Iran's foreign minister, has echoed a comment brought up many times before. The reality of the matter is that for years, this is, of course, the comments of the foreign minister. The reality of the matter is that for years, we have not obtained any benefits from the JCPOA. So the question is, why has Iran shouldered the responsibility of keeping the JCPOA afloat without gaining anything from it?
That's a good question, actually. I think that Iran has little to lose at this point by going along with the Vienna negotiations. I mean, it knows that the negotiations are a farce. It has every reason to believe they will go nowhere. But it has, I think it's rational for Iran to sort of string the U.S. along, to go along with this process, and to make a good faith effort to see these negotiations through to conclusion, even though it knows that that's extraordinarily unlikely. Because I think not to do so would give a huge advantage to the U.S. It would allow the U.S. to portray Iran as being recalcitrant, being unwilling to talk, being essentially beyond the pale, and therefore would justify offensive military actions by the U.S. and Israel. So I think that Iran is correct to go to sort of, you know, follow through on this diplomatic process, even though it knows that it's likely not to lead to anything good.
And Mr. Bozich, same issue I'd like you to address as well. Iran has basically been, in real terms, has been the only country that has been adhering to the JCPOA, but it has been gaining nothing from it during this time.
Well, you know, these are the facts of life on this planet today. We live in a world which is largely controlled by the United States and its colonial hold over other nations. You'll notice that the European powers that are supposed to be assisting in resolving this deal actually have no say in Washington. They can negotiate with Iran, they can come up with whatever solutions they like, but until they start to behave like independent states, nothing will happen. So what we're really dealing with here is the imperial empire structure of U.S. control of this world. And I do agree with your other guest that Iran must continue in good faith. Iran must do everything it can to demonstrate to the public of the world what kind of an adversary Iran faces. And I think it's very important that you here on Press TV discuss it, and that your representative at all talks speak to the media openly and explain what happens behind closed doors, because even the American people would never believe the way their own government treats other countries. That information needs to be shared. And then perhaps you can apply some pressure on the United States, both internally and internationally. Stay the course, be clear, state your rights, defend them, and hope that there are still a few honest people in Washington who will open their mouths and say that this is unfair.
Mr. Lazar, how would you rate Europe's performance regarding the JCPOA? For example, their commitments, their stance on the U.S. abruptly leaving the deal. Have the Europeans held up their end in all of this?
No, quite the contrary. They have failed to uphold their responsibilities by upholding the pact against U.S. attacks. This has been the most shocking development, you know, thing that's happened since 2015. Germany, France, they have not gone along at all. They have not defended the integrity of the Vienna process. And the Europeans, sort of have learned, you know, where things lie thanks to Biden's nuclear deal with Australia, which is a dramatic rebuff, stab in the back to France. So the U.S. treats its European allies with contempt, yet these same allies are afraid to essentially buck U.S. authority in any way. And Iran has been a primary victim of that European cowardice.
John Vozich, last question to you. How would you rate Europe's performance when you look at the JCPOA?
Zero. I'm sorry to say it, but France is here, as your other guest just mentioned. France has itself just been stabbed in the back, and its inaction is demonstrating that France is not a world power. Germany's inaction is demonstrating that Germany is not a world power and that they are just as much a colonial asset of the United States as they were years ago. This is a bad indication of the way the world is going, and I think that Iran is doing the best that it can and the best that anybody could under the circumstances, and I have to praise you for your patience. I must say that you need to stand by your position. It's the legal and correct position, and you need to recruit support from other countries that have received the hard end of the stick from America, because Iran is not alone. You are being targeted now, but you are just one of the many countries that has suffered this kind of treatment by the U.S. empire.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. That's all the time we have for its show. Thanks to journalist and political analyst John Vozich, joining us from Belgrade. Also thanks to journalist and author Daniel Lazar, speaking to us from New York. And allow me to thank my guests for staying with us on this edition of Spotlight. It's good night for now.
Limelight. Florida's version of the American dream, which holds that even people of relatively modest means can aspire to live near the water, depends on a few crucial components: sugar white beaches, soft ocean breezes, and federal flood insurance that is heavily subsidized. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Christopher Flavel. The piece is titled "The Cost of Insuring Expensive Waterfront Homes is About to Skyrocket." Florida's version of the American dream, which holds that even people of relatively modest means can aspire to live near the water, depends on a few crucial components: sugar white beaches, soft ocean breezes, and federal flood insurance that is heavily subsidized. But starting on 1st of October, communities in Florida and elsewhere around the country will see those subsidies begin to disappear in a nationwide experiment in trying to adapt to climate change, forcing Americans to pay something closer to the real cost of their flood risk, which is rising as the planet warms. While the program also covers homes around the country, the pain will be most acutely felt in coastal communities throughout the United States. For the first time, the new rates will also take into account the size of a home, so that large houses by the ocean could see an especially big jump in insurance rates. Federal officials say the goal is fairness and also getting homeowners to understand the extent of the risk that they face, and perhaps move to safer ground, reducing the human and financial toll of disasters. Subsidized insurance has been critical for supporting coastal real estate market, said Benjamin Keyes, a professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. Removing that subsidy, he said, is likely to affect where Americans build houses and how much people will pay for them. It's going to require a major rethink about coastal living in the United States. The government's new approach threatens home values, perhaps nowhere as intensely as in Florida, a state which is particularly exposed to rising seas and worsening hurricanes. In some parts of the state, the cost of flood insurance will eventually increase tenfold, according to data obtained by the New York Times. For example, Jennifer Zales, a real estate agent who lives in Tampa, Florida, pays $480 a year for flood insurance. But under the new system, her insurance rate will eventually reach $7,147, according to Jake Holhouse, her insurance agent. And that is prompting lawmakers from both parties to line up to block the new rates, which will be phased in over several years. "We're extremely concerned about the administration's decision to proceed," Senator Bob Menendez, a New Jersey Democrat, and eight other senators from both political parties, including the Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York, wrote in a letter on Wednesday, 22nd of September, to Deanne Criswell, the administrator of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA. Created by Congress in 1968, the National Flood Insurance Program is the primary provider of flood coverage, which often isn't available from private insurers. The program is funded by premiums from policyholders, but can borrow money from the Federal Treasury to cover claims. The average annual premium is $739. Until now, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, which runs the program, has priced flood insurance based largely on whether a home is inside the so-called 100-year floodplain, land expected to flood during a major storm. But that distinction ignores threats like intense rainfall or a property's proximity to water. Many homeowners pay rates that understate their true risk. The result has been a program that subsidizes wealthier coastal residents at the expense of homeowners further inland, who are more often people of color or low income. As climate change makes flooding worse, using tax dollars to underwrite waterfront mansions has become increasingly hard to defend. In 2019, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, said it would instead price flood insurance based on the particular risk facing each individual property, a change the agency called Risk Rating 2.0. After a delay by the Trump administration, the new system takes effect next month for people purchasing flood insurance. For existing customers, rates will rise starting next April. The change has won applause from a grab bag of advocacy groups, including climate resilience experts, environmentalists, the insurance industry, and the budget watchdog group Taxpayers for Common Sense. With a rapidly escalating threat of natural disasters, Risk Rating 2.0 is a much-needed and timely change, said Laura Lightbody of Pew Charitable Trust, which has pushed governments to better respond to climate threats. Higher insurance costs, she said, were a reflection of our new wet reality. The rate hikes around Tampa Bay in Florida are unusual, according to the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA. Most homeowners will see much smaller increases to their insurance bill, and many will experience a decrease, the first time in the history of the program, the agency said. As for those who may be forced from their homes by rising insurance rates, the agency noted that it has long urged Congress to offer financial help to lower-income residents, a more targeted type of assistance than simply subsidizing policies for most homeowners, regardless of their income. For the first time, our policyholder premiums will be based on their individual risk, said David Mostad, who runs the flood insurance program at FEMA. We pledge to continue to evaluate and make adjustments where and when it's warranted, David Mostad said. Lawmakers have responded to the change with alarm. Last week, 38 members of Congress signed a letter urging House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to block the change. We are concerned about the burden of potential double-digit rate hikes on our constituents by the Federal Emergency Management Agency FEMA's untested pricing methodology, the letter read, calling that burden too much for them to bear. Unlike current climate policy debates, which tend to break along partisan lines, views on flood insurance are less a matter of political ideology than of geography. All but three of the members who signed the House letter represent coastal states, including five Republican lawmakers from Louisiana and all 10 Democratic House members from New Jersey. The letter was signed by 19 Democrats, including some such as Grace Meng and Richie Torres of New York, who in other contexts have stressed the need to address the effects of climate change. Neither Grace Meng or Richie Torres responded to requests for comment. Charlie Crist, the former Republican governor of Florida, who now represents St. Petersburg as a Democrat in the House of Representatives, also signed last week's letter. He rejected the Federal Emergency Management Agency's argument that higher insurance costs would serve to alert people to the risk that they face. That's one of the most inhumane, callous statements they could possibly make, Charlie Crist said. We're going to punish you so you know what's going on. In the past, insurance policy has been vulnerable to political pressure. In 2012, Congress rolled back some of the subsidies in the flood insurance program, only to reverse course just 2 years later after voters objected to higher insurance costs. But the growing threat of climate change may make that kind of intervention less successful, said Roy Wright, who ran the flood insurance program until 2018 and now runs the Insurance Institute for Business and Home Safety. We cannot hide the truth of this increasing risk, Roy Wright said. We shouldn't hide it. We should tell people the truth.